ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The nuclear family idea, mum, dad, kids in a self-contained household, is not the norm in much of the world. But in many Western countries, it's often seen as the default and as something to aim for. As a model that grew out of a certain post-war political and economic context, is it still sustainable today? We'll look at what family models might best suit our needs in 21st century Australia in a moment. But first, let's meet a unique family who are challenging some of those traditional ideas that we've inherited. Rodney Chang Cruz is a lawyer who lives in Melbourne with his partner, Jeff, and they have seven kids, co-parented with five other couples. Rodney, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, a lot of people I say this to say, that sounds like a lot of work. Could you tell us a little bit about everyone and how they came into your family?
Well, it started basically when I grew up in a very traditional nuclear family that self-destructed, as many do. And I met my partner in 2000, and Jeff's from Taiwan. And he comes from a multi-generational, very different family that doesn't rely solely on biology. And I was introduced to that and found it fascinating and liberating in many ways. We decided that... Well, early on, we took in a niece who was coming to Australia to study. So she came and lived with us and has been living with us for now about 20 plus years. And then we decided to have our own child. We had Ethan via surrogacy about 17 years ago. And involved in that was an egg donor. There was a surrogate and her husband and her family. And a vast number of other people were involved.
So you've obviously maintained a relationship with those people
as
well.
Yes, very important for us. And then when we got back with Ethan from overseas, good friends of ours, Debbie and Lynn, a lesbian couple, said they wanted to be parents and said, could we have some sperm? So we provided that part of the equation and went into a co-parenting arrangement with them. And we have two children with them. Justin and Arky.
And so you've got quite a close relationship with them, haven't you? You're kind of at each other's houses a fair bit.
Yes, we spend each week, the weekend at each other's house, and the boys have all grown up as brothers, and we co-parent in a whole range of areas.
We'll get into the nuts and bolts of that in a moment. So that's four kids. Let's keep going.
Yeah, we also have a nephew who's been living with us for about 5 years. He's also from Taiwan. He's a biological nephew, whereas Jean was not biological. And we then went into another looser co-parenting arrangement with another lesbian couple. We have two kids who are 5 and 4.
And wow. Okay. So there's some closer relationships, some not so closer relationships, some geographically distant but still maintained relationships, and a lot of different people in the house. Rodney, what makes it work, do you think? Because there's a lot of different moving parts and a lot of different kinds of relationships going on, it sounds like.
I think the first thing I notice from my perspective, it works because I jettisoned this concept of the nuclear family being the gold standard and realise that actually, you know, that saying, the village, it's a village who raises a child, is very, very true. But it's not just raising a child. The village raises everybody in the family, in the collective, and they're there to support everybody. And that's the thing that attracted me, and it just works. It doesn't always work smoothly. Nuclear families don't work smoothly, obviously. It requires effort. It requires compromise. It requires understanding. But it makes the experience easier and shared. And shared experience is a much more enjoyable experience, I find.
The nuclear family is sometimes suggested to be on a kind of quite hierarchical model. And I should say that the nuclear family does work for a lot of people. There are still a lot of people living in nuclear families and enjoying that experience. But it can be seen as, okay, you know, parents at the top, sometimes the man above the woman in a heterosexual relationship, and then the kids below. How have you worked things out with all the different adults and children in your family structure?
Well, we try and treat everybody as an equal partner, and everybody has different roles, and those roles may change over time, particularly as the children grow. And the idea is that we all share responsibilities in everything from, you know, raising the children to funding the households, to being emotionally supportive and physically supportive. And, you know, we've got this wide range of childcare. You know, when the kids are really young, that is just wonderful to have that childcare support there. And it's cheap. It's free. It's part of the deal. Be part of this family and you'll be supported, and you pay for that privilege, if you like. It's not the way I like to think of it, but that privilege is dealt with by you giving back in some way and sharing that burden. And I've said the word burden, and I don't think it is a burden. When it's shared, burdens become less, and it makes it so much easier.
People are texting and questioning how the financial side of things works, because seven kids is a lot of kids no matter how you look at it. How did you divvy that up? Because often the nuclear family is quite a neat way to deal with finances, isn't it? They're just contained within that household.
Well, we're very leveraged on the work situations that we all have, and there's primary parents, primary caregivers, and then everybody else is a parental person in the family. And financially, it's who has the money and is willing to put into it, share it, the expenses, does it. And it doesn't have to be, financially, it doesn't have to be money. It can be provision of food. It can be provision of services. They're all equivalent to financial contribution. So if you don't have dollars, if you like, you can provide the labour and all the time, and they're just equally, if not more valuable, to be honest. There isn't a plan, there isn't a ledger or something we do. We just work with it as it happens. And of course, people's positions change over time. Some are not working when the kids are young, and then they go back into the workforce, so their role changes, and vice versa.
I guess another question that's bring to mind is, how do you deal with different parenting styles in a multi-household family?
Well, most of our arrangements have been based on we were friends anyway and we had shared beliefs and values, etc. So they give you a good basis, but that doesn't mean that all the parenting styles are the same. They're all different. The most important thing is that if there is something that we disagree with or we think there's an issue with, is to talk about it. But also, if ultimately a decision has to be made, we always defer to the primary caregivers in that case. And I have to say that we really haven't had any major disagreements in the 25 years we've been doing this. It really is just a matter of just having a chat.
That seems like a good strategy for many families, I would say. We're speaking with Rodney Chang Cruz, who lives in Melbourne with his partner Jeff and co-parents seven kids in different ways with different other couples. And I'd be very interested in your thoughts about how useful the nuclear family model is these days. I guess it has economic functions, it has relationship functions, it has social functions. What are your thoughts on how well they suit the circumstances that we're living under today? Andrew from the Northern River says, unfortunately, we're still stuck in narrow views of family in the most pop of pop culture. See Bluey, for an example. Yep, that's a heterosexual nuclear family with, you know, people coming in and out, aunts and uncles and cousins, but it's effectively nuclear. I wanted to have a quick chat to you, Ronnie, about the idea of privacy, because that's, I guess, a pro and a con of the nuclear family. You're in a self-contained household. That can mean that you have a sense of security and safety, and it's you lot against the world. But it can also mean that you're cut off from the world. What's your experience of that sense of privacy/isolation?
Well, I think privacy has changed in the last 20 years for me. I mean, social media has changed everything. But in terms of the way you've just phrased it, I think for us, privacy is important in the context of social media, etc., but it's not that critical. We find it's better to share our family more broadly and let people come and go. We've always said to our kids, family is the people you invite in. And they may be permanent, temporary, transitional, and they may come and go, over long periods of time. And so for us, privacy, there are obviously elements of privacy, but we try not to close our family off, because we feel that closes us off from, all these wonderful people that we've we've engaged with and had relationships with for the last, you know, 25 years.
And is there any final advice you'd like to leave people with if they'd like to explore a different way of raising a family?
I think is look outside the, you know, the classical nuclear Western model and have a look at communities of, you know, different languages, different cultural backgrounds, and see how they do it, multi-generational, you know, that whole concept in other cultures of having aunties and uncles who have no biological connection at all, but they're aunties and uncles or cousins or brothers or sisters. Have a look at that and explore that and see how that operates. I think people can find some elements that they can adopt themselves.
I love that phrase, family is the people you invite in. Rodney, thanks so much for joining us today to share your experiences.
Thanks for having me.
Rodney Chang Cruz with his partner Jeff, co-parents, 7 children across several different couples. A really interesting way to think about the concept of family and the mechanics of family as well. Journalist Marina Kamenev joins us now. She didn't grow up in the most traditional nuclear family herself, but when she imagined what a family was, that's what came to mind. So she began pondering why this image is still so powerful in our imagination, and the result is her new book, Kin, Family in the 21st Century. Marina, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you for having me.
What did family mean to you growing up?
You know, I didn't think about it growing up, but we were migrants. My parents worked a lot and my grandparents did the majority of the parenting. So it kind of was, you know, it was Russian nuclear because both parents were working full time. So it was never the mum and dad, 2 kids, and it was never a house because, you know, that was something that was foreign until I was a teenager for me.
And so when you came to create your own family, what thought processes did that spark?
Well, actually none, to be honest. And that's why, I mean, I was so interested in this book, in doing this book, because I didn't have to think about anything. I'm straight. I got pregnant. No one, you know, I didn't have to have medical interventions. And I had the 2 kids that I wanted. And so none. But it was just when I was raising them, you kind of really notice that there's an issue.
So tell us more about that, because a lot of people don't see deficiencies with the nuclear family. Tell us what you came to see were problems with it.
I don't know. It's just, you know, it's kind of like you're giving birth and then there's this moment where there's a lot of pain and you just think, this just can't be normal. Like, this can't be something that everyone does. And I mean, even when I had the newborn and I was living in an apartment, and I had a neighbour, Kate, who kind of became like a sister to me, but I needed her to shower some days just to watch the baby so I could shower. And then, of course, when I wanted to go back to work, and the thing is today you need 2 people to work to have kids because kids are expensive, but it's also impossible to work while you have kids because the school day, like the hours just don't line up, the school holidays don't line up. So, you know, there's just the system kind of isn't, it's almost like it's not even designed to work. And I was listening to Dan Savage talk about it with Ezra Klein, and he said it's a system that makes parenting as miserable, isolating and punishing as possible. And I kind of think part of it is true.
Yes, there's that idea that if you work, you have to work as if you don't have a family, and parent as if you don't have work, and neither of those things are possible.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Marina Kamenev, who's been thinking very deeply about our attachment to the nuclear family and whether that's useful and sustainable. Tell us a little bit about this idea that it's a historical fluke, that it just kind of grew up in a particular moment, because it seems so eternal and monumental.
Well, in some ways it is eternal and monumental. It's always existed, but it became a really big thing after World War II. First of all, women kind of, you know, had a taste of freedom, because they had to work during that time during the war economy. And then they had to kind of, and then they went back to, I guess, their kitchens or the domestic space. And when the men came back, they could afford to buy a house, which was something that they would have to wait for before because the post-war economy was doing really well. And so they started to marry younger. They started to have more kids. And this lasted for just about 30 years because then choice kind of became more of a thing. And then the economy collapsed as well. So surviving on one salary became kind of impossible.
That choice becoming more of a thing, are you talking about whether or not to have kids? Because it sounds like the nuclear family, from reading your book, was partly founded as a response, or, you know, partly came to prominence as a response to this fear of women's promiscuity. Tell us a bit more about that in the Australian context.
Well, it's just during the war, there was a lot of panic when women were suddenly going to work. And even like with venereal diseases, there were reports that the venereal disease during the war was going up because all of the American soldiers were in town. And as usual, they blamed the young women being promiscuous for that. And I guess because people, you know, women wanted to have sex, and marriage was the way to do that.
And so when you say there then became a time in history where women had more choice about their fertility and their sexuality, what happened to the nuclear family?
Well, it started to decline. I mean, you can see in 1961, the pill was introduced to Australia. It was expensive. It wasn't listed on the PBS, and it was only available to married women, more or less. And the fertility rate started to go down straight away, because women could suddenly have more choice about whether to have children or not, and that was huge. And then when single women could have the pill, there was another kind of plummet. And as well as that, after 1970, the age of marriage started to rise. So the other thing that was happening with the post-war period is people were marrying younger and younger and younger, and possibly because some women were pregnant before marriage and they had to either get married or, you know, give the child away for adoption. And in the 70s, all that changed and the economy changed.
We're speaking with Marina Kamenev, who's a journalist who's written a book called Kin, Family in the 21st Century, which explores some of the turning points in our understanding of family and our ability to make different kinds of families, and our continuing attachment to the idea of the nuclear family and whether that's a useful thing. Just interestingly, Marina, statistically, how common was the nuclear family during that post-war period? Right? It was certainly in the cultural imagination, the norm. Was it actually that, statistically speaking?
Well, I mean, in Australia, Aboriginal families weren't part of the census at the time. But, you know, it peaked during that period for sure. I think it was kind of the most common family at the time. And then it's steadily declined since.
When you mention Aboriginal families, you note in the book that Indigenous families in Australia and Black American families had quite different ideas of kin. Tell us a bit about some of those models.
Well, I guess in America, because Black families moved around a lot due to slavery, they couldn't set up and have a nuclear family historically. So there's this whole culture of fictive kin, and it's less about blood and more about connection. And in Aboriginal families, and this is from what I've read, I don't want to make, you know, big assumptions, but it's a classificatory, I can't even say this word, kinship system where the aunties and uncles play a greater role in a child's life. That's, from what I read, can be equivalent to the parents. So there's multiple parents, and equally elders without children have a role in the community. So, you know, everyone has a role, and it means not only are the children kind of looked after in these communities, but so are older people.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, Aboriginal people were not allowed to marry without asking permission until 1967. So it's hard to get a sense of, how powerful those kinship structures might have been if they'd been allowed to flourish.
Yeah, and depressing as well. It's very sad.
Really outrageous, yeah. You also write about the discoveries that changed the way we were able to have babies, so the technology of sperm donation and insemination. So basically, disengaging the reproduction of babies from the physical act of sex in some ways. How powerful was that? How influential was that?
Yeah, it was very powerful. But it was also quite horrifying to the church, which is quite funny because it's not a culture that really celebrated sex in the first place.
But within marriage.
Within marriage, yeah, and to produce children. So, you know, that was what sex was for. So it started on all these kind of threads really started to untangle. I mean, at first it meant that infertile couples could have kids, but that was the veneer of the nuclear family was still very important. So they would pretend that, you know, the the father was a biological father and ignore whatever happened at the fertility clinic. But later it gave women more options to either have kids on their own and other women. And this wasn't technology. This was, you know, the turkey baster. But it allowed families that weren't straight, or people that weren't straight, to create families and be a bit more creative about those families. And these people were often rejected by their own families. So they could kind of, you know, pave their own way.
That's interesting too, because you spoke to a lot of different people with a lot of different family models. What did you learn about what the word kin means to different people, Marina?
Well, it wasn't just the word kin, but I learned that everything was kind of highly subjective. And I found it really fascinating because there's no rule book. You have single mothers by choice, and some use the sperm bank, and those who do, some connect with the other siblings that the sperm donor has created, others don't. There doesn't seem to be a rule book. And then there's also the children created by the technology, and they have feelings about this. And I've only kind of mostly spoken to the people who were upset at the way that they were created, and they feel that they were really, you know, that their identity was stolen or taken away from them. They don't have access to it, or... And that's been another kind of something I've taken for granted anyway.
So you're right too that the shadow of the nuclear family, you know, still looms large. What impact does that have on people who are trying to create different ways of having families?
I think it's hard because the language isn't there. So that to begin with, it's getting better, but just even passport forms and the laws and fertility clinics and you kind of have to ask, and it means that their family is interrogated in ways that mine isn't. So no one's asked me why I have kids or, you know, whether you know, or how I had them. But I think Rodney, who I interviewed for the book, he gets asked, you know, who's the father all the time when it's really none of our business. So all these little things that I didn't think about before, I could really see.
And after immersing yourself in this work and these ideas, Marina, have you made changes to the way you do family or imagine that you'd like to do family in the future?
It's not that I made changes, but I kind of I had an understanding of what family is to me. And obviously I have my parents, but I just remember the day my mother-in-law died in England, and I had all these people... I didn't even tell people, they were just checking in by text. And people checked in and one came over and packed my suitcase so we could fly to England that night. A friend in England bought clothes for the kids, winter clothes. And they knew, everyone kind of came and they knew intuitively what to do. And I kind of thought to me, well, that's what, I feel like those people are my family. And the other thing I thought, well, if they feel differently about me, that's okay. But yeah, I guess it's friends with benefits, but not sexual benefits.
And we've got a text to finish up with that said, you know, you've been talking about raising a family and almost all the language used assumes there are children. Mm-hmm. I think there's more to be questioned than what is covered here. And there's more in the book than what we've had a chance to cover here too, I will say.
Yeah.
Marina, thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters today. It's been fascinating to dip a toe into your research.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Marina Kamenev is a journalist and author. Her book's called Kin, Family in the 21st Century. And earlier you heard from Rodney Chang Cruz, who has 7 kids, co-parented with 5 other couples, and shared his experience about some of the different ways that can be done outside the nuclear family model that many of us have inherited, but some of us have realised doesn't work so well for us.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.